Welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you joining me from all over planet Earth. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless. And just for today, remember my old friend, John Denver.
Thank you very much. Good evening once again. He was born in the summer of his 27th year, coming home to a place he'd never been before. Left yesterday behind him, you might say he was born again. Might say he found the key for every door. When he first came to the mountains, his life was far away. On the road, hanging by a song. But the string's already broken, and he doesn't really care. Keep changing fast, it don't last for long. The Colorado Rocky Mountain High, I've seen it rain and fire in the sky. The shadow from the starlight is softer than a lullaby. Rocky Mountain High, Rocky Mountain High. He climbed Cathedral Mountain, saw silver clouds below, saw everything as far as you can see. And they say that he got crazy once and tried to touch the sun. And he lost a friend who kept his memory. Now he walks in quiet solitude, the forests and the streams, seeking grace in every step he takes. His side has turned inside himself to try and understand the serenity of a clear blue mountain lake. Colorado, Rocky Mountain High, seated rain and fire in the sky. You can talk to God, listen to the casual reply. Rocky Mountain High, Rocky Mountain High. Now his life is full of wonder, but his heart still knows some fear of the simple thing he cannot comprehend. Why they try to tear the mountains down to bring in a couple more, more people, more scars upon the land. In the Colorado Rocky Mountain High, I've seen it rain and fire in the sky. I know he'd be a poor if he never saw an eagle fly. Rocky Mountain High, it's the Colorado Rocky Mountain High. I've seen it rain and fire in the sky. Friends around a campfire, everybody's high. Rocky Mountain High, Rocky Mountain High, Rocky Mountain High, Rocky Mountain High. All right, good to have you back. As I said, from all over the planet, it's an amazing thing about podcast technology that allows me to sit here on the outskirts of Chicago
and you're listening in Sydney, Australia today. It's just a fascinating thing to me. There's a lot about technology I don't find very uplifting, but this technology I find a great way to reach the world, so to speak. And this show today is about a man who reached the world for so very, very long and still does today. My friend John Denver was known the world over as one of the top-selling recording artists in history. And while that's, I think, what propelled him to the top of the charts, no doubt, I've always found his work just this side of more important than the music. They obviously, one fed the other. There's no doubt about that. But I've always been enamored with what he did with his platform that he created and performed on. But then he used that to enhance the greater good, for lack of a better term. And that, to me, was always what attracted me to his efforts. A kid growing up in Chicago, the music was first, of course. You know, I remember the first time I heard Country Roads, and I was at my grandmother's house in the yard, and there was a transistor radio on, and it was 1971, and I heard this song, and I kind of, wait, what? You know, I was, what, 13 years old at the time, so, you know, the door's kind of wide open for something to come in and grab you, and I think what was going on in the world at the time, with Vietnam winding down and Watergate ramping up and all the other crap that was going on, this guy's voice somehow cut through that and pulled people together, and the great artists do that. So that was my first memory, I think, of hearing that song. And little did I know. And quite frankly, let me just go back a couple seconds here. This past week, I've been recording the audiobook for my second book, Every Moment Matters. And I'm recounting in there things that I have not literally looked at for a decade. That book came out in 2010. And I don't spend a whole lot of time going back and looking at it. Obviously, I wrote it. It's out in the world. I'm very, very proud of that. And it's, you know, goes where it goes. But recounting how I got to the point where I was even writing books or even on the radio, you know, that all goes back to John and his support of me and his influence on me. And I think there are people that come along at certain times, certainly in my life and probably your life too, where they see something in you you cannot yet see in yourself. I have coaches that have done it. My parents have done it at times. I have some great friends that have done it. But this was a little bit different. This was the guy that I heard on the radio when I was 13. And somehow the universe, the tumblers that make all things come together, when you get out of the way, put us together over time. And I was writing just a couple days ago that it was 10 years ago today, I believe it was 10 years ago, 9 years ago today, that, no, it was 11 years ago today. Get your math correct. It was 11 years ago this very day that I was in Aspen, Colorado for a book signing at Explore Booksellers, that was hosted by Annie Denver. And listen, for a kid from the northwest side of Chicago, whose best grades in school were lunch and gym probably, and maybe I did okay in history, it's a long way from all that for me. And so I was recounting a couple days ago about that sort of anniversary of doing that event. And at one point, you know, I'm sitting there in a sold-out room in Aspen, and I'm recounting, much as I will in this podcast, you know, the strange, wonderful, interesting route to becoming friends with John and then him, you know, urging me to go forward in life and all those type of things. And there was this whole, you know, there's a few hundred people in the room. It only holds like 100 people. I think it was wall-to-wall humans. And I realized it's very surreal. I'm standing there talking to these people. And if I look to my right, there's Annie Denver sitting there smiling at me. And this is a woman whose song I heard for years, long before I met John. And, you know, you kind of get to those points where it's a bit of a pinch me in the ass moment. It's like, how does this all happen? I don't know how it happens. And it's best off that I don't know how it happened because you just get in the way. But serendipitous is the word we use, but it's far more than that. It's far deeper, broader, and brighter than that for me. And so every time October rolls around, especially October 12th, which was the date that John's plane went into the ocean off Monterey Bay, people have gathered all over the world to remember this guy. And I always think about that, you know, to live your life in such a way, in a good way, not in a bad way, but in a good way, that you're remembered by millions of people, if not once a year, but maybe every day. That's way out of behind my comprehension. But the fact is that tells me that what he did, the work that he did, and the music legacy he left behind is just, it just doesn't end. And I thought it would, quite frankly. Listen, he wasn't, you know, he at one point, depending on who you listen to and where you find your numbers, he sold between 60 and 100 million albums, about 35 million in the U.S. alone, and then double that around the world. So you get to be 60, 65 million albums, you've done okay. But even still, it's been 24 years since he died in that plane crash, and you would think that it would drop off, and that is not the case. As I record this show, there are people gathered once again, as they have for 24 years, in Aspen, celebrating his life and music and legacy. And again, I thought at some point it would drop off. I've actually been to one of those celebrations. Probably it was right around the time, I think it was the same weekend I did the book signing. I think it coincided with the book signing, which would explain the huge crowd that was there, because, you know, people love this guy, and rightfully so. And it was a great, great, great experience. But once was enough for me. I got to be there and experience a little bit what it was like to see people so attracted to this guy's music and doing work in the world. And it's the kind of thing that counterbalances or pushes back a little bit for me on the erosion, all the shit that's in the headlines. And there's this undertow, this rumbling underneath all those headlines, a lifeline of sorts, because of a man's music and because he lived and because he did what he thought he was supposed to do. It's never far away from me. It can't be. I'm sitting in my studio, and on the wall is a poster of a picture that John took. I think it was in spring somewhere, because there's tulips up and there's snow on the ground. And it was given as a gift to me when I spoke at the Windstar Foundation in 1994. John gave all the speakers these autographed posters and framed. And it was a wonderful thing. And then about 6 years later, maybe 7 years later, in 2000, 2001, I gave that away as a gift and kind of forgot about it. And then about a year and a half ago, when I was getting ready to create and host the Bridge show that was broadcast around the world, it connected me here in Chicago to co-hosts in Beijing, China, with the purpose of understanding each other a little bit better and talking about things that matter. And it reminded me of a lot of what John was all about. He was a bridge builder with his guitar and his voice. So just before all that happened, I was reached out to by the guy that I gifted this to. I couldn't remember the guy's name. I don't even remember who I gave it to. And out of nowhere, this guy shows up and sends me an email and said he was moving, and he had the poster that I had gifted him back in 2010, and he wanted to send it back to me. He didn't know why, he just wanted to send it back. So it literally got here 3 days before we cranked up this bridge project in 2020. And so it's sitting here on my wall, and I look at it every time I'm doing a show. And to see John's signature there and the concept of Windstar, which was literally bringing the world together for 3 or 4 days in Aspen, and I was so proud to speak there, it's all top of mind for me. So what I attempt to do every year, remembering this guy, is to come at it from some sort of different angle. And it's very difficult for me because I've talked about this stuff over and over. And I never want to overdo it, but I also don't want to underplay it. You know, I would not, to my conscious knowledge, not be doing this today had he not intervened. And I'm not talking about country roads. I'm talking about an event that took place in, 1992. I was watching The Tonight Show, working third shift at the Ramada Hotel O'Hare, the now defunct Ramada Hotel O'Hare. And I had gone back to college, and I was trying to put my life back together. My daughter was born, is married, and I was sitting there getting ready to go to third shift at the hotel as a security guy, because, you know, that's where all the fun is. For a guy like me, that's fun. So I was getting ready to go, and I happened to turn on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and Jay introduces John as his guest that night. They were great friends. And he also mentioned, Jay Leno mentioned, that John was performing at the Wang Center in Boston on December 3rd of that year. So just not long, you know, a month and a half away or whatever. And I had this overwhelming nudge that I needed to go see John. Now, I already knew him a little bit. I'd met him a couple times at Windstar here and there. But, you know, and in 1989, he came to Chicago and did an event called Higher Ground, and Bill Curtis and I spent time with him. So I kind of knew him a little bit. He knew me by name, nothing more than that. But I felt like this was different. So the next day I bought an airline ticket. It was Continental Airlines. Remember those guys? I don't think they exist anymore. Continental Airlines, round trip to Boston and back was $150. I recall that clearly. So I get my ticket. I fly to Boston. No idea what I'm supposed to do there. Zero. I'm just supposed to show up. And so at Logan Airport, I get a cab. I said, take me to a hotel near the Wang Center downtown. They drop me off at this little nameless place by the ocean. I have zero idea what I'm doing. This is what running on faith is all about. You know, going where you think you're supposed to go, even though you have no idea what may or may not be waiting for you. Had a great lobster dinner, as they call it, lobster. Had a great lobster dinner there. And walked over to the Wang Center, and I saw his name on the marquee. So I go back to my hotel room, and I'm thinking, now what? And so I started calling hotels in that area, in the Boston area. And on the third try, I got a hold of Chris O'Connor, who I knew a little bit as well, who was John's road manager at the time. And I told him I was in Boston, and he says, well, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm supposed to talk to John. He said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm supposed to talk with John. Do you have a ticket to the show? No. Does he know you're coming? No. Okay, well, we'll get you a ticket. And he'll have 15 minutes ahead of time to talk. And I thought, no shit. So anyway, I get there. There's a ticket waiting for me. I get there way ahead, you know, an hour before the concert. And the guy lets me in. The nice old security guy lets me in. And I'm sitting there, and it is snowing like hell. And 15 minutes goes by, 20 minutes, half hour. They're really late. And all of a sudden, the door opens up, and here comes Chris and John and James Burton and Jim Horn. His whole band is there. And he looks at me. John looks at me, and I look at him, and he goes, what are you doing here? I have no answers for any of these questions these guys have been asking up to this point. And he just kind of said it, and I didn't even have a response, so he left. And Chris comes up and said, listen, I'm really sorry. You know, the concert's no problem. Enjoy it. Here's a free ticket. He said, but there's no way. The weather delay, and there's no way there's going to be time to talk. He has this big press thing afterwards, blah, blah, blah. He said, what I can do in the interim is, you know, here's some cheeseburgers, and I'll take you downstairs. You can wait, you know, we're in the band area until the doors open up, and it'll all be fine. I said, okay. So I'm sitting literally under the stage at the Wang Center eating a McDonald's cheeseburger, which was very delightful and never turned those down. And all around me, John's guitars are getting tuned up. I could see the electronic tuners going back and forth. There was like six or eight guitars. And I'm sitting in the dark watching these things, and I could almost feel palpable the energy. It was just very, very interesting to me. And again, I have no idea why I'm there. Zero. So finally, you know, being the guy I was at the time, I don't know that I do most of this stuff now, but I, you know, just running on empty. So I went upstairs and I walked up and I found my way to the top of the stage where the entrance is on the right side, and they're rehearsing. And I just kind of walked on stage without realizing where I was at. And the whole band stops and they look at me, and Chris comes over. He's like, you can't be on stage, dude. I said, listen, where are you guys going to be tomorrow night? And I'm trying not to sound like a fanatical person, because I didn't know why I was there. And he says, we'll be in Pittsburgh. And I said, I'll just meet you there. And he goes, listen, 5 minutes after the show, that's all you can. Okay, fine. So great concert. It was a fundraising concert for Catholic Charities of Boston. They raised like $250,000. It was just a wonderful Christmas / Denver playlist concert. And John was an incredible voice, and it was just a beautiful thing. So afterwards, I go downstairs, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting, and I see a bunch of other people waiting and waiting, and you know, they're at the other end of this hallway, and I see John talking to them. I'm like, okay, so what do I do, stand here? So I just stood there under a bare bulb in the Wang Center basement. And finally they all left, and he looks at me, and he comes walking over, and he sticks his hand and goes, what are you doing here, pal? I, it's not Chicago. I said, well, I know that. I said, I was supposed to come see you. And he says, why? I still think about it today. And I said, I thought you'd know. Like there was some grand answer that he was going to give me in that moment when he said, why? And he looked at me cockeyed. And then he says, did you bring me something or what? And I'm not shitting you. I had no conscious memory of ever thinking I needed to bring something to give to him. And about a month or two earlier, I had been giving talks at schools in the Chicago area about environmental responsibility and awareness. It was the degree that I was working on at Northeastern Illinois University. So it fell in line with my degree program. And I was doing talks to, you know, to grammar schools and high schools and stuff like that about environmental responsibility and awareness, something that back then, even in the early 90s, was just starting to take place. So I had these letters short letters, but letters nonetheless, in my jacket pocket that some kids had written me. And all of a sudden, oh yeah, I got these letters. Like I knew what I was doing. And I pulled these letters out, and couldn't tell you what they said, but they were all very nice. And, you know, what a great job I had done and how important it was what I had said. And he goes through three or four of them. He looks at me, he goes, do you know what you're doing? I'm like in the moment or just, you know, in the big scheme of things? And I said, no. And folks, this is what I wanted to get to, the turning point. There's a pivot point in here, and this is it. He looks at me and he says, do you know your voice matters? I did not. I mean, I'd been doing some things, but the concept that my voice would have any influence one way or the other was zero. And he puts his right hand on my shoulder and he looks at me in the eyes. He said, John, your voice matters. And the coming years will prove me right. I know this. I know this. And all of a sudden, I just felt like this, like somebody poured warm water down my back. It's, I can't explain it. And all there was like this small ding confirmation that I could contribute somehow. And for a guy who, for the most part, and not in any nefarious way, but mostly was, you know, I never, you know, I'll take what I can get, but give back, not so much. It was a shift for me. It was going from, you know, third gear into fourth, and it was a big thing. And I just was dumbfounded. And he says, listen, put these letters in my bag, and I got to go to this press thing. He said, but don't you ever forget that your voice matters. And we hug each other, handshake, and off he goes. And I don't know what happened. So I walk over and put the stuff in the bag as instructed, and I leave the Wang Center. I said thanks to Chris on the way out. He kind of winks at me, and off I went into the snowy Boston night and walked the Boston Commons and thought, what the hell just happened here? So I get on the flight, go back home. Probably a month later, maybe a little longer, I get a phone call from the Windstar Foundation in Aspen saying that Mr. Denver brought your letters to our board meeting, and we've all decided that we must do something more, you know, to reach the school kids. At that point, they were doing this event called the Symposium, which you had to go to, you know, physically be there in Aspen, which was a great thing, but it was no outreach at the point where there was an educational piece, and said, you know, we need to do this and we'd like, you know, get your input on it. I thought, well, gosh darn it. There was a purpose to that trip after all that I did not see, of course, when I bought that airline ticket. That's the beginning of it, but it sure isn't the end of it. That was in 1992, a year later, skipping a lot of stuff, bouncing up and down. I was a substitute teacher by that time at my high school, Schurz in Chicago, and I had a mailbox there. And one day I got a flyer in the mail. It would have been that September of 92. Can't remember the dates, folks. It gets a little murky after a while. But anyway, I got this flyer in the mail, and it said next year that the Symposium was called Choices for the Future of the Human Family. And another bell went off in my brain. And for the rest of the day, I couldn't concentrate in school. Not that I ever did anyway, but I was having a hard time because these words were coming to me. And I wrote them down. By the time I got home, this whole poem had written itself. I'd never had that happen before. It's like automatic writing. And I sat in the yard and I just rearranged a couple of things. I thought, what is this for? The human family. And fast forward a year, just about 8-9 months maybe, and gosh, it's even longer than that. Just 2 weeks before the symposium, the next year in 1993, again, I'm skipping a lot here because we don't have time for it, but it was an up and down roller coaster. I absolutely knew on some level I was supposed to be speaking there. But up to that point, I hadn't really done anything except speak at a couple of schools. I was not on the radio. I hadn't written a book. TED Talks didn't exist. So none of what I am quote-unquote known for today was not even on the radar. 2 weeks before that symposium, John's office calls my house, and I never forget, I was cleaning the cat box at the time. I may have voicemail, I don't even know an answer machine, but it was like, don't, you know, ignore this call. I run upstairs, I answer the phone, it's John's office, and the call comes in, and he says, what are you doing in 2 weeks? I mean, we were planning to go to the symposium anyway. That's why we're planning to come out to Aspen to do the symposium. He goes, could you speak at the symposium for me? What? So Dr. Mae Jemison, who was the first female black astronaut in American history, was on the schedule, but she had to cancel, and they call me. I thought, what the what? So once again, these tumblers fell in place, and things came together, and we fly out to Aspen. And of course, it was great just to go there, you know, to be a participant and be part of it and be in the audience and feel these things and learn stuff and be inspired and all the kind of things that I find, you know, critical in life at times and very important. And we fly out there and, you know, we're put on, it was a whole different deal. Now I'm on the other side of the fence. Now I'm on the stage. And so it was just an incredible thing. And the Saturday of the event, it was a bright, sunny, beautiful day, much like it is here in Chicago today. And the woman in front of me was a big-time scientist, biologist, you know, from the World Wildlife Fund. And she had six assistants. I'll never forget it. We're in the green room, six assistants and reams of paper. And her name was Dr. Theo Coburn, the late Dr. Theo Coburn. And I had three words, or actually three questions on a piece of paper. That was my entire talk. So she got up and basically, you know, jammed them up pretty good. There's, you know, 5,000 people in the audience, whatever it was in Aspen. And, you know, this is end time stuff. And she's was there to wake them up. That's for sure. And I think, how the hell do I follow that? So when it was my turn to come out, Roland Smith, who is, you know, the voice from on high, he's up there with Bill Curtis in terms of voice resonance, tone, and tenor, gets up and he introduces me, and I walk out and I have a piece of paper with three questions on it. And I did a talk called The Ripple Effect. And I think I got like 45 minutes. You get a half hour somewhere in there. I can't recall. And I finished the talk with the poem, The Human Family, that I wrote a year earlier without knowing why. And that poem is in every book that I've written. It's in Living an Uncommon Life. It's in Every Moment Matters. I also believe it might be in Phenomenon, but I'm not sure. So, you know, at some point, the tumblers really started clicking. And I realized with John putting me out front and center that time, and, you know, I've never sent a thank you note to Dr. Mae Jemison for canceling either. But for a kid like me who came up on the streets of Chicago on the Northwest side, like I said, and everything was pretty well black and white and my future, I never thought would include anything that I'm doing now. It is a long, interesting, difficult path to be on. And I find the value of making the changes in my life that I've made of the highest order. None of that happens without John. None of that happens without him saying to me, do you know your voice matters? And not only just saying that, but then pushing me out on stage to prove to myself in front of thousands of people that I'm supposed to do something. I've never looked back from that. So as I sit here today remembering him, the music's great. I love it. I play it at times, you know, when I need to be reminded of things. But it really came down to the work for me. That whole Windstar project deal was 10 years, I believe, of symposiums and bringing people together and getting people a little bit of an awareness to what we all can do in the world while we're here. John died when he was only 53. It was a shocker, of course. And there are still times, amazing to me, that I will still tear up at a certain song, or if I hear something or see something or am reminded of something, it still gets me. And I think that's like the measure. And he's not the only one, of course, but that's the measure of the connection. That's the measure of the love and the respect you have from someone. 24 years later, I still get caught. And that's a good thing. So I'm thinking of him today, and of course, you know, Annie, who was so generous to put together that book signing in 2010, and then she had a private book signing at her home that night, and we've spent much time together at John's Sanctuary and having dinner, and, you know, these things are all part of the puzzle of my life. I don't always understand or recognize where the pieces go, but usually when I get out of the way, they fall together. And so when I was getting ready to do this today, I started thinking about all those people in Aspen that are gathered one more time to sing his songs, to put that energy out into the world. And I keep thinking, man, can you imagine doing something like that, as I said, and that people still come together from all over the world and spend 3 or 4 days celebrating that you were here. It's a fascinating thing and fantastic thing and well-deserved for my old friend. So what I thought I would do is wrap this up with a interview. Back in 2007, when I was at Oprah Radio, I produced and host, along with my friend Catherine Murphy, for the Oprah Channel, but also other Sirius XM channels, called John Denver, The Man and His Music. It was a 3-hour tribute to John on the 10-year anniversary of his death. So, as I mentioned, that was back in 2007. And I reached out to some of my friends and their friends and to kind of get a retrospective of John and how his life affected people that were in his life at different levels. And the first guest was Annie Denver. We had a wonderful conversation with Annie. And my friend, the late, great Terry Lipman, was on there. G'day, mate. He's from Australia. Great stories to tell about John. And he was actually in the process, when Terry passed away, of doing a documentary called What One Man Can Do, based on John's song. And so he was there. And oh my gosh, Milt Okun, John's famed producer, and Hal Thaw, John's business manager, and the late, great Roger Nichols, the immortal Roger Nichols, and his wife, Connie Reeder. Roger engineered quite a few of John's records, and they went to the Soviet Union together, and they went to China together, and Connie sang backup, and you know, Tom Crum was there, who he created Windstar with. I mean, it's just this full of people that all wanted to talk about John. Michael Martin Murphy, the great country music singer, was talking about John and how he'd have starved if John didn't record some of his music. And so all of that was there. It was a 3-hour blowout, 2 hours of interview, and then we were able to get some pretty exclusive live versions of John's music and make a concert kind of last hour out of it. And I was very proud to find out that that project that we did there at Oprah Radio for John was nominated for a Peabody Award. It was very cool. We didn't win, and that's okay, but just to think that it was even considered was, Jesus, I don't even have a degree in this stuff, kids. I don't even know what I'm doing half the time. How the hell am I nominated for a Peabody Award? Anyway, it was a great thing, and so I went back and listened to that not too long ago, and I just yanked about 13 minutes out of that to finish this podcast about John with my friend, another John, John Barry, who is a Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter. He's had a slew of hits in the 90s. He's got to have one of the top voices in the world today when it comes to tone and tenor and range, and unbelievable guy. We've been friends for, God, it's getting more and more, probably 20 years now, 15, 18, 20 years, somewhere in there. And the more time I spend with him, the more respect I have for the guy. He went through cancer about 2 years ago. And, you know, throat cancer, nonetheless, and beat that back. He's had a brain tumor. I mean, this guy lives everything he sings. And so he was took time out of his schedule. He was kind enough to join us back in 2007. And I just thought it would be a good way, instead of me blathering on all the time about JD and what he meant, not just to me, but other people, to have another voice in this podcast. So I'm going to let my friend John Barry take it from here. Interesting to me, when I taped that Oprah special, I was sick as a dog. I had the flu, and so you can listen to different parts of the show in its entirety, and I sound different in every part. I was on more meds. I was drinking NyQuil in shots, I think, just to stay, you know, coherent enough to continue. So my voice sounds very different than it does now, not to mention the fact that for whatever reason, my voice has dropped about 9 octaves in the last 10 years. So anyway, with all of that being said, I thank you for, you know, spending time with me today and remembering a truly remarkable human being, a man whose musical talents were endless and boundless, and his work in the world was important and timely, maybe even ahead of his time. And I just think there isn't a day that goes by where something around me reminds me of John. And I think there's more to be done. And the few do the work for the many. And whatever platform I'm given, and I've had a lot of them, whether it's writing books or doing TED Talks, countless radio stations, and this podcast, I go back to what he said to me that night so long ago at the Wang Center in Boston. Do you know your voice matters? And I would ask you the same thing. Do you know how much your voice really matters? You know, one of the things that drew me and millions of other people to John Denver's music, what this guy had, it's like a 5-octave range. I mean, I never heard a human voice. I was actually at the Chicago Theater in the late 1980s, 87, 88, somewhere in there, and it was a Christmas concert. And he was singing a cappella, O Holy Night, and the seats were shaking in the upper deck there. It was an amazing thing to hear this voice that very few humans possess. I mean, if you go to an opera, you expect that. But I don't think a lot of people got, because what the voice that you heard in concert, of course, doesn't always come across on, in those days, vinyl and then CDs. But he had this amazing instrument. And to me, as Henry Wadsworth Longfellow said, the human voice is the organ of the soul. And there's another guy whose voice really reminds me of John's tenor and power. That's, of course, John Barry. He's one of the most distinctive voices in country music. And about 3 years ago, I did a John Denver tribute show when I was still on the air in Michigan, and JB was kind enough to join me then, and he does so now from Georgia. Hey, John.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. Obviously, much like, we're about the same age, you were drawn to John's music when you were a young guy too, and when he came to the Omni in Atlanta. And that voice thing that I was talking about, can you expand on a little bit?
Well, you know, it's just John had that beautiful way of singing a song, but not in a way, he was singing with you. He wasn't singing at you. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if everybody understands quite the difference in that, but it was just, there are singers, and I have to say that I have been, I will accuse myself of being one of those people that in the past where I have sang at you, you know.
Okay.
And other people do that too, and they just, and they sing in such a way that you don't feel you don't feel comfortable or invited singing along.
So there's not a real connection.
Right. But John had a real gift for singing in such a way that made you want to sing with him. It was a great gift. It was just a real gift of communication.
Do you remember the first concert that you went to where you saw him way back at the Omni?
1975, May of 1975.
When you left that concert, what had changed for you?
That was the very first concert I'd ever been to. And, you know, to be there, and I with 18,000 of John's closest friends and neighbors, and to share that music. It's really funny when I hate to jump ahead, but when I went to see him many years later with my wife,
mm-hmm.
she kept elbowing me in the side, going, "You do that. That's how you do that.
Uh-huh.
That's where you get that from." That is, you know, whatever communication type that I have, that's where it came from, and just, you know, seeing. I think that's what when I left there, with this desire to emulate this man and his music.
Mm. You know, one of the CDs that somebody, I think you guys sent me a few years back, was your Songs and Stories CD, and you tell on that album, you guys still call them albums, right?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
you were telling about the time where you, I think, were changing the oil in the tractor, and your wife came out and had a little surprise for you. Can you share that?
Yeah, we lived on a farm north of Athens, Georgia, for many years, and I was in my barn changing the oil in my farm tractor, and I heard her call me down from the house, that faint voice through the trees calling, "John!" And as I laid there with oil dripping on my forehead, I remember thinking to myself, now, she's got 2 feet. But knowing what's good for me, I jumped up and ran to the front of the barn and said, "Yes, dear." And she said, "Come here." I think that's actually my middle name, John Come Here Barry. And so I reluctantly went down to the house, and she said, "You need to come in and get ready. We're going to Atlanta. I've got a surprise." I said, "I can't go to Atlanta." I said, "I'm in the middle of something I can't just walk away from." She said, "Mom's watching the kids. Come on, get ready. I got a surprise for you." And I'm not a surprise-oriented person. Some people go, ooh, yeah, surprise. I'm not one of those guys. I'm like, no surprise. And, but, of course, knowing what's good for me, once again, I went in and got dressed, and I'm trying to find out where we're going. She's not giving up any information. Mm-hmm. We get in the car to drive the 70 miles to Atlanta, and the worst thing of all, she has to drive. As the commercial says, there are drivers and there are riders. I am a driver. I drive. And but this particular trip I didn't get to. She drove. She knew where we were going. I had no idea. And we get downtown Atlanta. We exit off on North Avenue, and we're crossing over the bridge, and there it is, the Varsity hamburger joint. And I'm mm-hmm. like, I love this woman. She's bringing me all the way to Atlanta to take me to the Varsity. And this is love. And she drives right past it. And I'm like, where are you going? She goes, we're not going to the Varsity. I said, why not? I will love you more if we go to the Varsity. And she keeps going. She said, you're a nut. I'm going to keep going. And she turns left on Peachtree Street, and there on the marquee of the Fox Theater, it says, live tonight, sold out, John Denver. And I just decided not to even think that's where we're going for fear she won't turn in. Mm-hmm. And but she does. And I said, so why are we here? She says, I got tickets. I got fourth row center stage tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just dying. I living out in the woods like I did, I didn't even know John was in town.
Okay.
And I was beside myself. And
had you seen him since 1975 in between then?
I don't think so.
So it's been a long haul.
It had been a long time. That's, you know, and enjoyed his music and seen, you know, television things and different mm-hmm. odds and ends, but never live mm-hmm. since that time. It was just a spectacular night. We laughed together. We sang together. The ushers came and asked me to sing quieter than John. It was great. And then we, after the show, I thanked my wife for just a spectacular surprise. And she said, that's not all. And I said, what do you mean that's not all? She said, we got backstage passes. I said, what are you talking about, Willis? And so back we went, and I got to meet John, and I was, you know, we were there. I don't know. There were 20 or 30 of us in the meet and greet room, you know, and he met everybody, and Rob and I were last in line, and he said, "Who are you folks?" And I said, "I'm John. This is my wife, Robin." And man, we just really enjoyed the show. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but thank you for a great night. And out the door we went. My wife, she smacked me in the arm. She said, "Why didn't you talk to him? Why didn't you tell him you just put out a record called?" That's when Faces had just come out.
Mm-hmm.
She said, you listed John as your most important musical influence. Why didn't you talk to him? And all I could say is I just didn't know what to tell him. And, you know, it was not too long after that when this tragedy happened, and later that year. And, you know, I wish I'd had that opportunity to say hello. Matter of fact, I do have to say that I did do a show with John.
You did?
We played together at John Day up in Wisconsin.
John Day?
Yeah, it was a big festival. There was John Michael Montgomery, John Barry, John Denver. Little Texas, I think, was there because one of their members was named John.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody on stage was either named John or were in a band with a member named John. And but we didn't get to meet. We were on at different times,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't get a chance to meet him or actually get to see him because we had to head back out. We played about 2 hours prior to John, and then we had to hit the road, and
mm-hmm.
so I didn't get to see him then. But his music meant a great deal to me, and I, you know, so much of what I do performance wise is because of what I learned by listening and watching John Denver, and it is in my show. I still do Annie's Song most nights, and I tell the story about meeting John and the surprise from my wife. And I kind of sum the story up because here's a woman who loved me so much, who provided this wonderful opportunity in my life that meant so much to me. And I get to sing this song, and every night I just sing it as best I can. If there was some way that John could sing through me that night, I just sort of make myself available for that to happen. Just that little moment that I get to say thank you to a man and to his music that has meant so much to me in my career. It's been a real treat to get to visit with you and to talk about John and his music, and it's pretty amazing what he has meant to so many people.
You fill up my senses like night in a forest, like the mountains in springtime, like a walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert, like a sleepy blue ocean. You fill up my senses, come fill me again. Come let me love you, let me give my life to you, let me drown in your laughter, let me die in your arms. Let me always be with you. Come let me love you. Come love me mountains in springtime, like a walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert, like a sleepy blue ocean. You fill up my senses.